you don't want the shadow cabinet room to be an echo chamber of the leader. The leader doesn't want that. You take things to shadow cabinet because you want a good discussion.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. In the wake of the budget, Labor remains ahead in all the main polls, but it has come under criticism for some of its post-budget stands. There was a leak about the division in shadow cabinet about what attitude should be taken on the Medicare levy increase. And some comments by Anthony Albanese have reminded people of his leadership ambitions. Beyond that, economic policy remains a challenge for Labor. It must be credible on economic management if it is to maximise its pitch to voters. Today, we're joined by Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen to discuss the budget fallout and Labor's agenda. Chris Bowen, former Labor Minister Craig Emerson has said the ALP should support the government's budget measure for the Medicare levy rise as is, instead of trying to confine it to higher income brackets. And he's also said you should back the schools package, which is based on the Gonski needs principles. Now, what's wrong with his arguments?
Well, of course, I have a lot of respect for Craig, but let's go to the points that you raise. Let's deal with the Medicare levy stroke NDIS first. Now, in relation to the Medicare levy, we accept there's an argument to increase revenue. Firstly, the NDIS is fully funded. That's a separate question. The government is running quite a dishonest campaign and, frankly, an immoral campaign, which makes recipients of the NDIS worried about the future of the care that's provided, because the measures that Labor put in place in office were enough to fund the NDIS, and there has been no blowout in costs. But we do accept the need to increase revenue for more broad budgetary measures, of which the NDIS is just one part. Now, in that context, we were faced with a decision, a choice, back the government's position, which would increase tax for every working Australian with an income more than $21,000 a year, or come up with a model which raises the same amount of money, roughly, in the first instance, more money in the longer term, but is more progressive. In the context, Michelle, that real wages are going backwards, we had that data confirmed last week, ordinary Australian real wage earners are going backwards. In the context that no low-income Australian has had a tax cut since the days of Julia Gillard, and in the context that every Australian earning more than $80,000 got a tax cut last year, and in the further context that every Australian earning more than $180,000 will get a tax cut this year. And so we said, well, why don't we support the Medicare levy rise for those over $87,000 and not proceed with the removal of the deficit levy, given we're still in deficit, which would raise more money in the medium term than the government's plan. So there can be no questions, even if we accepted NDIS was unfunded, which we don't. But even if we accepted that, there can be no question that it doesn't raise enough money, but is fairer and more progressive in this context of real wages going backwards and the need for more fairness. And so it's a policy which I think is eminently defensible, is the right one, and the Australian people have a choice now. Here's the point. Both sides, quite unusually in recent Australian politics anyway, both sides will go to the next election promising a personal tax rise. Both sides. The government will increase personal tax for everybody over $21,000 a year if they win the election, and we'll increase tax for everybody over $87,000 if we win the election. That's the choice.
Now, we do know, however, that there was some division among senior Labor figures about whether to back the levy fully or only in part. And, of course, Julia Gillard, when she increased the Medicare levy, had it across the tax brackets. You're saying circumstances are different from then?
Yes. Yes, they are. We accept the need to sometimes increase the Medicare levy, but in the context that I just explained about real wages, about tax cuts for people over $80,000 and tax cuts for people over $180,000 this year, I think the circumstances are different. Now let's just tackle this matter of shadow cabinet head on. Obviously I'm not going to go into who said what. I never will. I will say though that you would hope and expect that shadow cabinet would have a good discussion around the issues and the options available. I would hope the cabinet would do that. I would hope the shadow cabinet would do that. And I will say in general terms, I've been involved in a lot more rancorous and difficult debates around cabinet rooms and shadow cabinet rooms than I was for this one. This was a good-natured discussion with a proper examination of the pros and cons of different approaches.
I guess the point about the fact that that discussion did reach the media was that it was leaked, and this has been a pretty tight opposition.
I accept it's been a tight opposition. We've been disciplined and unified, and that needs to continue.
And so you're concerned about that leak?
Well, obviously you prefer not reading about these things in the newspaper when people, as I said, have a proper discussion around the table and people contributing as you would hope. You don't want the shadow cabinet room to be an echo chamber of the leader. The leader doesn't want that. You take things to shadow cabinet because you want a good discussion.
Now, you've made a quite detailed and complex argument about the Medicare levy and your position. But on schools, surely the government's plan is at least an improvement on current arrangements, much more needs-focused. Couldn't you have just accepted that and promised to build on it rather than simply rejecting it?
Well, I think we're seeing that argument play out with the Greens, aren't we? I mean, Sarah Hanson-Young has thought about that, and she has been comprehensively slapped down by her party and, frankly, by educators and people interested in the future of education, because they know this is a con job. They know that this is not really needs-based funding. They know that this is effectively a cut from the agreements with the states. It's not just us saying that. The New South Wales government, not known for their socialist tendencies, say this is a cut in funding. So we can't vote for a cut in funding. We can't vote for a policy which is not really needs-based. I mean, there was a lot of play made early about the 24 schools that have had their funding cut, you know, the very wealthy schools. Well, that's fine. You know, we're fine with that. We welcome that. But now it's come out that actually that's not even actually accurate either by reports. And, of course, within that you have the subset of the Catholic education system. Now, I didn't go to a Catholic school. My children don't go to a Catholic school. I don't happen to be a Catholic. But I respect the role of Catholic education. And I respect the importance of parental choice when it comes to education. And the Catholic education system educates a lot of young Australians. And in evidence which I have not seen effectively rebutted, the Catholic Education Office has told me and has said publicly, in many instances they would have to double school fees as a result of this policy. Now that either means a lot of people doing it tough have to find a lot more money, or they have to withdraw from Catholic education, so choice is gone, and that puts more pressure on the public system.
But it is true, isn't it, that the Catholic sector feels hard done by, potentially, because it had a lot of special deals that inflated its entitlements.
No, I can't accept that premise. I mean, what really has annoyed the Catholic Education Office in my conversations with them is, one, the lack of consultation. There's absolutely no consultation with them. It's not just about the quantum. It's also about the design, and there's been no consultation with them about the design. So that what basically Simon Birmingham has said to the Catholic system is, here's my model, take it or leave it. One size fits all. Now, the Catholic education system is different to the independent sector and different to the public sector. They have their own models. Frankly, there's cross-subsidisation of schools in poorer areas, in areas, frankly, like the one I represent, not high on the socio-economic indices. And, you know, they've said that, for example, fees in my electorate would double, and I know what impact that would have on families and public schools and Catholic schools in my area if that were to occur. It's not acceptable. So, I mean, on that alone, we wouldn't vote for it.
Do you accept that overall the model is more needs-based than the one we have at the moment?
Well, Michelle, being needs-based is a bit like being pregnant, isn't it? You are or you aren't. It's either needs-based or it's not. And again, as I said, there was some, you know, early celebration that 24 schools who are overfunded were going to lose money, and now it appears on further analysis that, you know, some very wealthy schools are actually going to get big increases. Poor schools are going to go backwards. I mean, the Northern Territory, I mean, an area where they're educating, an area of high indigeneity, high disadvantage, I mean, gets very poorly treated in this deal. I mean, how can we look ourselves in the mirror and say that's acceptable, all that would vote for that? We cannot.
Now, a headline in the Financial Review today read, and I quote, "Cynical ALP puts budget in jeopardy."
Nothing like a bit of objective reporting, is there?
Do you risk, however, people seeing you as taking positions for reasons of expediency rather than reasons of substance? Is this a danger for the opposition?
I think every political party has to explain their decisions. I mean, in all seriousness, I like the Financial Review. I read it regularly. And this is not a reflection on the journalist who wrote the article. He's a very fine journalist. But I don't think that headline, which I'm sure the journalist didn't write, I don't think that headline reflects, frankly, good objective journalism. That is a subjective view by, obviously, you know, somebody in the editorial team in the newspaper. And while they are more than entitled to have an editorial, to have opinion pieces, I just do not see how that is objective journalism on the front page of the newspaper in terms of that headline. And I think the Financial Review might want to reflect on that, because it is, they can criticise our policies. I couldn't care less. They can do that up and down. That is their perfect right in the editorial page. But a headline like that just is not a reflection of reality, and it's not journalism. It is political propaganda.
Now, the opposition is supporting the bank tax, but you have quibbles around the edges and you are questioning whether it's going to raise the revenue that it is supposed to raise. Do you have any independent figuring about a revenue hole here? Or do you think that hole is likely to be substantial?
That the hole is real. It is real, and it's not just me saying that. I mean, Michelle, we have in Australia corporate reporting obligations. So if anything is material to the value of a company, it must be reported to the stock exchange openly and transparently and accurately. There's a legal obligation on firms to report accurately, and the banks have. 4 out of the 5 banks have already reported to the stock exchange how much they'll pay. Guess what? It doesn't add up. It doesn't meet what the government says. Now, they have an obligation under the Corporations Act to tell the truth. Scott Morrison doesn't. And I'm not here to defend the banks, far from it. But I think the banks know their liabilities and their balance sheet better than Scott Morrison knows their liabilities and their balance sheet. And so he has a shortfall of $2 billion over the next 4 years. That's very substantial. This is 2 weeks from the budget. 2 weeks and he's got a $2 billion hole. This is about competence.
$6 billion plus.
Correct. This is about competence, and frankly, it's about honesty, because yesterday the Treasurer moved the goalpost. It's very complicated. I don't want to send your listeners to sleep. But, you know, he changed the test from the fiscal balance to the cash balance. He's wrong, in fact. He's just wrong. This is not a matter of argument. This is a matter of black and white fact. He is wrong. Now, either he doesn't understand his own budget. That'd be concerning. Arguably, it's more concerning if he does understand it and he's not told the truth about it.
How important do you think the issue of budget repair is these days? Do you think that people are really not willing to accept substantial budget cuts anymore? And is this really going to compromise our fiscal position over the next decade or two?
I think people are willing to have a conversation. I think that people do recognise the need for budget repair. Both political parties agree with budget repair. We just have different methods of doing it, by and large. I mean, there's plenty we do agree on, but there are others we disagree on, which is a matter of some highly contested political debate. I made the point at the press club the other day. I think you were there, Michelle. I've been struck by the number of people, since Labor's been announcing policies for the last 2 years, who've come up to me and said, I'm a loser under your policy, and I support it. Negative gearing, capital gains tax, superannuation in particular. Now, these are generally people of greater means, you know, wealthier people, particularly around superannuation, who come up to me and say, I'm a massive beneficiary of the tax breaks in superannuation. I use them. I'm not proud of it, but I'm not ashamed of it. I just comply with the law. But good on you for changing them. And I'll be worse off. And while they're there, I'll comply with them. But I think it's right that you change them, because it's not fair and the budget needs to be repaired. And I'm not talking one or two people. I'm talking, you know, a not uncommon event for people to come up to me and say that in the airports, which I regularly frequent, or the streets of our capital cities, etc. So that's just one example. I mean, that is people of, as I said, greater means. But I find people are willing to make a contribution, but they want to know it's fair. They want to know that others are making a contribution too. They want to know that it's been thought through. and they want to know the reasons for the change. And where you can explain a difficult change, like, I mean, a lot of people, Michelle, thought we were nuts when we did negative gearing reform, thought we'd lost, you know, probably the last election and the next one, because negative gearing is the great Australian dream. But I think we've won that debate. And it just goes to show you can take a difficult reform if you explain it, explain the reasons, explain why the nation's better off, you can win that argument.
One way of getting some budget repair would be to adopt the so-called Buffett rule, which makes it mandatory for higher income earners to pay a certain proportion of tax, at least a certain proportion. And yet you say that you wouldn't do that as Treasurer. Mm. Why not?
Well, Michelle, firstly, I completely accept and agree with the rationale behind the Buffett rule. You know, I accept the what people are trying to achieve. I don't accept that method of doing it, but I accept the philosophy behind it.
And why not the method?
Well, the method, firstly, the Buffett rule, it's, people call it the Buffett rule or the Buffett tax. It's actually a Buffett concept because it doesn't exist anywhere. No country's done it. And you think if it was an easy thing to do or a good thing to do, that maybe somewhere around the developed world, some country would have done it. And when you look at it in detail, I think there's a few reasons. Unintended consequences, or perhaps intended for some people, but unintended, there's the issue of charities and philanthropy, which is a tax deduction. There's the issue of investment in venture capital and risky business, which is a tax deduction, but one that's very important for the nation. And at its core, Michelle, this is probably my main objection. People say, oh, that's great, you put a floor under tax avoidance. I say, I want to get rid of a tax avoidance. Certainly rid of tax evasion. I don't want to give permission for, you know, people to pay 35% tax. I want people paying their fair share of tax by getting rid of the tax concessions which predominantly benefit high-income earners. So, very quickly, negative gearing, regressive, benefits high-income earners predominantly. Capital gains tax, even more so. 70% of the benefit goes to the top 10% of income earners. Superannuation, 30% to the top 10% of income earners. So we've fixed all those in our policy. And finally, last week, much smaller in terms of dollar figures, but very important in terms of fairness, we announced that we would cap the amount you can claim as a tax deduction for managing your own tax affairs at $3,000. Now, not many people do this, but when they do it big time. There's 48 people in Australia who paid no tax who earned more than $1 million in the last figures we have. 19 of those use managing tax affairs to get their taxable income down from $1 million down to zero. So they use it big time. Now, the average Australian claims $378 on managing their tax affairs, by which I mean, you know, accountants primarily, some lawyers. But some people claim hundreds, you know, huge amounts of money to get their income down. And that's not fair. So we'd cap it at $3,000. So what we've gone and done is gone through those tax concessions one by one, carefully looked at them, identified the reforms, got the policy right. Nobody has laid a finger on any of the policies we've announced in terms of the unintended consequences because we've thought it all through. That's the way to achieve the same result as the Buffett rule, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Also on tax, Labor obviously opposes the unlegislated company tax cuts. We've been told that many times, but it's not said yet what it will do with those already legislated for companies up to 50 million a year annual turnover. Isn't it somewhat unsettling for business not to have your position out there on that point? And can you give any indication of when you might in fact reveal your position? Well, will it be sooner rather than later, or will it be right at the end election?
No, it won't be right at the end before the election. But Michelle, the next election is due in 2019.
But it could be in a year's time.
Well, it may be, but a lot of things might happen. It's certainly not going to be any time, you know, in the immediate future. You can criticise us for many things. I don't think you can criticise us, though, for not being upfront about policies. You know, we have taken the most detailed policy offering to the Australian people of any opposition since John Hewson in 1993. That has some risks, but it's the right thing to do. And we'll be the same on company tax. Now, we're taking a bit of time. We're looking at all the implications. I've commissioned, you know, quite a body of work.
On that matter?
Yeah, to inform my recommendation to Shadow Cabinet.
What sort of work would that be?
Well, looking at all the implications, you know, implementation details, the fiscal impacts,
And that's from an outside group?
Well, from, you know, obviously our commission work from the Parliamentary Budget Office, there's Treasury analysis there, there's all sorts of stuff on the public record that I carefully sift through so that when I make a recommendation to the Shadow Cabinet, it'll be a good one and a firm one and enable a good discussion. Now, oh, we'll reach a position in plenty of time. You talk about uncertainty. Every business person, every Australian will be very clear on our policy. You know, the government will tell you that they've legislated everything that they said they would this term. That's correct. So the next election is another chance for the Australian people to look at the two competing tax plans, both personal and company. There'll be a clear choice. Ours will be a detailed position. You know, the question time in the last sitting week on this matter was the most farcical I've seen in 13 years in Parliament. You've been here a lot longer than I have, Michelle, and with, you know, great respect. So you might have seen more farcical, but I haven't, where the government couldn't name the 10-year cost. And then, you know, over about seven questions or whatever it was, we got out, it went from $50 billion to $65 billion. I was expelled from the Parliament for asking Bill to stop asking because I didn't think the nation could afford it if he kept going. So this is policy on the run by them. Well, I engage in proper policy development.
Could I just ask you about a controversial project, the Adani mine? Mm. Labor seems a bit all over the shop on this federally and in Queensland. This week, for example, your Labor Senator, Lisa Singh, said the mine would be a huge mistake for this country, and yet Bill Shorten has supported it, subject to certain conditions. What is the position, and do you think this mine is, if you support it, is it important, or are you just going along with it for the sake of not alienating Queensland voters?
Michelle, it's a interesting point, this. The government's sort of setting up this argument that if you don't support a subsidy for Adani, you're against the project. Now, I thought the age of entitlement was over. I thought corporate welfare had finished. Now, here we have the situation where the Liberals and Nationals appear hell-bent on throwing taxpayer money at this project. Well, the coal mines in the Hunter Valley didn't have taxpayer subsidies that this project will be competing against, in part. The fact of the matter is that the NAIF, the North Australia Infrastructure Fund, has not spent $1. It was announced in 2015. Has not spent $1 on a tourism project, on any sort of services projects, and any manufacturing. Nothing in Northern Australia. And yet the government says, well, we're going to spend, you know, almost $1 billion on this rail line for Adani. And if you're not for that, you're against Adani. Well, I actually think that taxpayers' money is not for corporate welfare. Taxpayers' money is for projects in the national interest.
And now, do you think this one is?
Well, I've been, you know, through Mackay and Bowen. It's a highly challenged in economy. Great place, Bowen. I love the name and I love the town. But, you know, they're doing it tough. Unemployment's high. The mining boom come down has affected that area. So, of course, any project which creates economic activity and jobs in that area is something which should be welcomed, subject to the normal environmental processes and conditions. I don't think that should be a controversial statement, really. And I'm not convinced that it needs taxpayer funding. If it stacks up, it stacks up. If it's such a great project, it stacks up. Now, Adani had previously said they didn't need the subsidy. It stacked up. They didn't, you know, obviously they'd take it if it was provided, but they don't need it. Well, if that's changed, they need to say so. And if they don't need it, then why would the taxpayers spend money on it? If they do need it, maybe the project isn't economically sustainable.
Now, finally, to come back to a general question, although in all the recent polls, Labor is doing very well, your primary vote is still very low. Why do you think that is, and are you concerned about it, and can you do anything about it, or are people just turned off the major parties?
I always want the primary vote higher than it is. I wouldn't care how high it is, I want it higher. And that's that's the key job of a politician, isn't it, to get your primary vote higher, because you want to be the first choice of as many Australian people as possible to do good things. Now, you know, as Joel Fitzgibbon once famously said, the manual says we don't comment on opinion polls, but it would be churlish to deny that they don't show us consistently in the lead. You know, I welcome that. Obviously, I'd welcome the higher primary vote. Everybody would. But I welcome being in the lead. And, yeah, major political... But the political environment is more fractured and fractious than it has been. You know, the old days where people had a choice between Labor and Liberal are gone. People now have a choice between Labor and Liberal, the Greens, One Nation, Cory Bernardi's party, you know, the Shooters and Fishers, and, you know, we could go on. And so that changes the environment. Now, I want people voting Labor because I believe in the Labor government being the best choice for Australia's future. And, yep, sure, we'll go out and campaign for a higher primary vote. And where we can't get that primary vote, I'll campaign for Labor preferences. That's the system we work under.
Chris Bowen, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Balage. And we'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.